Thursday. You know what? Time has been really, really flying the last, however long the quarantine has been happening.
There's definitely a multiplier there.
And I basically was living a quarantine life before that, to be honest. So I don't know what exactly the difference is now, but time does seem to just be flying through. I'll look at the clock and it'll be 4 o'clock. And I'm like, well, you know, I'm done working for the day. What do I do now?
Yeah, I noticed it when I actually went to visit some family this weekend, and my sister-in-law had a baby, and the baby's 7 months old, and I'm like, what? It was born when? 7 months? Like, what even happened since September? I don't know.
Yeah. Actually, Watson turns one tomorrow, like today or tomorrow, I think, is what the pound said his like birthday was. So happy birthday, Watson. When he's 1, 7 years old now. What is it? 1 year, 7 years, 7 dog years is 1 human year.
What does Watson get for his birthday?
Gets to go to the lake.
And some doggy cupcakes.
Puppy Chipotle. I don't know. Who knows? We'll figure something out. He has no concept of time. So, but yeah.
Chipotle. No, Chipotle just sounds like something you get in Boulder.
Well, doesn't Starbucks have like a puppuccino or something?
Do they?
I'm pretty sure. Yeah. Pretty sure that's awesome. A thing. But yeah, time does seem like it's flying. It's feels a little strange. I've been feeling like, I don't know, just lots of changes, right? So I think we talked about me changing roles a little bit at Sidedoor. And so I think what's sort of making time go faster or feel just way different is that I'm so used to measuring my productivity and how much time I was able to spend coding something or programming something or refactoring something. And now I don't do that at all during the day. And so I don't know why that makes the day feel so much shorter, but I've been sort of feeling like the day's been really short. And then also that sort of compounds the feeling of, am I actually being productive? Am I contributing good things to the company? All that stuff. And really, I'm just trying to figure out how to feel productive when I'm not sitting in a text editor for as many hours as I possibly can. Because before that was the game, right? Try to get back to the text editor so you can like do your real work, right? Like the quote unquote real work. But yeah, I think I'm really struggling with that, trying to figure out, or really like trying to understand when I'm doing the real work, even though it doesn't feel like I am.
Yeah, I think it's hard because you don't have metrics. I mean, if you were, it's not like you're reporting to anyone, but you could very easily, you have very concrete results of writing code. You've got branches, commits, PRs, releases, issues fixed. Like those are numbers you can track and you can point to that and say, hey, I did this and this today. And that's that can give you kind of the sense of moving forward and accomplishment. But when you're writing documentation or designing wireframes for things or like working on business requirements, it's definitely a lot more nebulous because you can't really, you know, it's not like you have to but it's not like before you're reporting lines of code as a performance metric to anyone, like God forbid, right? But it still feels that way. And yeah, I definitely can understand. I don't know so much about the making things go quickly because I know kind of on the flip side, you know, when you get in the zone or you get in the flow state, right? Time can pass almost instantaneously when you're really working on a hard problem. So I don't know, maybe you're just kind of in that mentality, but you're in a flow state for design instead of actually coding things.
I don't know. A lot of my day is spent chasing people down and trying to get answers, chasing one or two people down. Like, hey, how do we say this? What's a unified voice? Like, I'm basically trying to just do all the different jobs that aren't necessarily being done that's not programming now. So my big project this week was making one unified Notion document of our, I don't know, verbiage, how we, I don't know. So basically it's like a problem solution doc, right? So I have our different target markets. So like designers, brands, in each section, I have like problems that they have and solutions that we offer, like left, right columns. And so I'm basically chasing people around and be like, hey, I think I got this right. Did I get this right? And then sort of consolidating the feedback between the two people and making sure they're on the same page. So I'm trying to help translate the vision from the CEO to the sales marketing guy and make sure it's like logged in one spot. Cause the sales marketing guy has many documents, with different types of verbiage and taglines and whatever. And so, yeah, I'm trying to consolidate things over. So a lot of my time is spent actually now waiting for feedback. So the rest of my time is spent like reading, maybe like reading about landing pages and things like that, reading about all the stuff I don't know, like, for example, how to consolidate your brand's copy. But yeah, I don't, maybe that's what it is. Like, I feel like I'm in limbo half the day. And so that's why it feels like time is flying. But that's what I've been doing.
You're just over there playing Minesweeper, waiting for an email reply.
So I've actually been hitting these afternoon 20-minute naps, and it's been amazing.
What?
Yeah, it's been amazing.
Doing some polyphasic sleep cycle over there, or what?
Well, no, I don't know. I usually don't sleep a ton, and I wish I slept more, but I just wake up. So no matter how late I go to bed, I just wake up at the same time between 6 and 7 a.m. No alarm, and my brain just is awake. But for whatever reason, since the quarantine stuff started happening, I've been waking up between 4 and 6 a.m. and just being awake. So after a couple of weeks of that, I just turned into a zombie. Yeah, so I tried different things, tried staying up later, tried melatonin, tried whatever. And I, you know, like usually jujitsu is my hard workouts and that resets my body, but gyms are closed, so I can't do that. So instead, what I've been doing is if I can't sleep at night, I sleep during the day a little bit. And it's been amazing how like I'll set a timer for like 25 minutes and I'll go lay down. Watson will jump in bed and then wake up after 25 minutes and I feel just so much better. And like my focus is restored. So that's been my life hack, I guess, recently, is hitting those 20 minutes. Like, hey, everybody, I'll be back. I'll be right back. You know, they don't know what I'm doing. Like, they don't know that I'm sleeping, but it's been really helpful for me.
Props to you for being able to do that, man, because I, no way has that ever been any part of my cycle. Soon, like, I can't nap for 20 minutes.
Really?
I just, you know, 2 hour minimum, and then I'm dead for the rest of the day. I don't know, it's just, just don't operate like that.
Oh, so you're one of those people where it's like, when you wake up, it's like you have to pull your soul back from another world?
Yeah, naps, forget it. Yeah. Forget it. I can get up in the morning, no problem. Yeah, I'm going until bedtime.
Yeah, yeah. But that's been my life, honestly. Like, not too much tech stuff related. I guess I've got a couple of side projects going, which we talk about. Or there's a podcast I wanted to talk about a little bit too. But I see here that on your list of topics, you've mentioned Python, and I'm interested to hear about what's going on over there, because we've never talked about it. I've never used it. I've never typed a single line of Python in my life. So I want to hear what you're doing over there.
So yeah, I've been learning Python. I was talking the past couple weeks about doing this contract work for Glance Networks, working on some of their DevOps stuff behind the scenes. And I mentioned last week how we kind of arrived at this solution for doing the auto-scaling, where instead of having the single sort of source of truth Rails web-based application thing, we just have each little server that runs its own code and figures out its own state and brings itself up and tears itself down. And then the question was, okay, that's cool, you got to write this code. What do you write it in? Now, I obviously have my languages of choice. My first inclination would be Ruby, because it's just awesome as a shell scripting language. I know the tooling, I know the language. The standard library gives you everything you would need for that kind of thing, and you can pull in AWS's client if you wanted to and use that. Or if you just have a couple API calls, you could just do normal HTTP REST stuff and be done with it. But as I kind of alluded to, like, there's no real Ruby or Rails present in this company at all, so that's kind of a non-starter for you know, forward-looking maintenance things.
Right.
I thought briefly about using Node, which also would have been an okay fit. I've never actually done sort of any Node besides browser stuff. Like, I've done Nuxt and everything and some Electron, but I've never really done anything really like pure Node, just doing OS random scripting stuff. And also, Node's not really installed in these boxes right now, so we didn't really want to add all these extra dependencies and stuff. So that was kind of out.
Okay.
The other option was shell scripting. And I'm just like, no way, that's not happening. Yeah, I can't maintain that. It's the worst. I'm trying to move away from that stuff. So, yeah, they have a lot of, one of their main server applications is written in Python, and they use Tornado, which is some kind of WebSocket thing. I don't really know. They don't use Django or anything, but the server is Python.
Okay.
And so I'm like, well, let me look at this Python thing. Let me take a look. So first of all, I found a book. I'll see if I can find the link, but I think it was called like Using Python for DevOps Management or something. Just a whole book about this one subject. And I was like, oh, that's pretty cool. Read through the table of contents on Amazon, realized, oh, there's nothing here I can't teach myself. So then I just started reading through the Python docs and just playing around. I haven't actually started the project yet or really written any code, but I just have a couple initial thoughts just from reading and playing around and kind of understanding the mentality and how it's structured.
Tornado looks a lot like your standard Express style, you know, request lifecycle framework, like web framework.
Okay, that kind of makes sense.
Express, Sinatra looks pretty similar.
Sure, okay. But I think they're primarily using it for the WebSocket support that it brings as well. Yeah.
Yeah, so let me lay your thoughts on me. I need to hear this. I need to know what I should be thinking about Python.
Please don't take this as any source of truth for anything.
I got my Apple Pencil ready. We're going to take some notes.
First of all, wow, it really feels like Ruby. I mean, I had no problem just diving in and pretty much understanding how things were laid out, how the class system works, how the typing works, how modules work, how inheritance, and it's all like pretty straightforward in the sense that all of the ways I think about structuring applications can just be brought over wholesale, and I like won't even lose any time having to think about that because they are structured very, very similarly, almost interchangeably, I would say, for most applications. So that was just really comforting, just knowing that, okay, now what stands in between me and implementing this thing is, you know, syntax, standard library stuff, and maybe figuring out the tooling. And that's all just kind of implementation details anyway, so I'm not super worried about that. And the documentation seems fine and complete, so great. There it is.
That's really, that's neat. I guess, like, it's cool to sort of realize when you have that level of experience, when you can look at another ecosystem and start making those connections back and forth, like, oh, this is like that, this is like this. And then you start to have to, really what you have to do at that point is just sort of fill in the gaps, right? So that's what I was doing with Go. I was sort of correlating it to my previous framework experience and looking for like, okay, this can fill that gap, this can fill that gap. And yeah, that's sort of how I was able to build, I guess, the API project relatively quickly, even though as frustrating as it was. So it's neat to hear that with, you know, happening with you and Ruby and Python.
Yeah, and whereas Ruby feels like it seems kind of magical, and there's a lot of conveniences and sugar and kind of sort of implicit things that you kind of have to know. And you can really only learn by experience or by making mistakes. I guess that amounts to experience. Python seems a little more straightforward, explicit. Again, it's not like it has fewer features or smaller surface area or anything, but it just seems more intentionally designed. Ruby kind of grew out of all these different methodologies of message passing and then kind of functional things as well. And then you've got all these weird mismatch of syntaxes for the standard library for different things. Some things are classes, some things are modules. You've got weird C constants and stuff mixed in there. I'm sure I'll find weird sharp edges like that in Python, but it feels like, I wrote this in my notes here, like a language designed by computer science nerds who are passionate about languages. Hmm. Like some guys got together, and this is my headcanon, I don't know if this is true, and we're like, what do we like about these languages? We're going to explicitly pull these features out and put them into this one well-designed thing that's also sort of pragmatic and kind of, I don't know, more dynamic. So that's kind of really what my main takeaway, at least from reading the documentation. They explain exactly like what influenced the different language features, what languages they drew from. Some of the stuff I had never even heard of before, but they're like, yep, this is this and this is that. I was like, oh, that's cool. These people, these were intentional design decisions, and they're right there in the docs, and they explain where they come from and why they were that way and what the trade-offs are. So I thought that was really really cool and refreshing.
Yeah, it sounds like it draws a lot of parallels to Elixir, honestly. Right, you look at Elixir and up front, it's you made for, you know, highly concurrent applications and things like that. And I think even before I got into Elixir, when I just started looking into it before I started writing it, I think that's all what I was seeing too, was that Jose was working on some stuff and he was really frustrated with how he was having to do with Ruby or the edge cases he was running into. So we started looking for things that would specifically solve those problems.
Yeah. And to be at a point where you even know what problems you're trying to solve is already a huge step. You know, it's not like I'm choosing Python 4. It's any of its particular language features here. I'm just kind of forced into this corner and that's fine. And I'll be comfortable enough with it. I mean, listen, it's my job to be a developer. It's not my job to be a Ruby evangelist, right?
Right.
It's fine. I'm going to pick a tool for the job that is the appropriate thing. Yeah. It's going to take a little bit of time to get spun up and get comfortable and productive with it. But that's just what you got to be.
That's a good way to put it. Yeah. Your job is to help them be productive in the long run and not necessarily evangelize or convince them as to why X technology is better or more efficient or what, you know? Yeah.
Yeah. And we talked about that a lot recently where we're kind of exploring different languages and PHP, and I was looking at Rust and you're doing Go, and it's like, it's hard to disconnect yourself from all the time and energy you spent learning a particular language or a tool set, or just even just like Vue versus React, or, you know, that kind of stuff. Just the Vim versus Emacs, whatever, tabs versus spaces, whatever petty argument you want to pick in computer science.
I was going to say that kicked back up again because Deno, I think Deno hit 1.0 this past weekend. And so if people aren't familiar with Deno, it's the Ryan Dahl, the creator of Node, a while back. I don't know if it was a number of years or so, but I'll put a link to the show notes. He gave a talk at a conference about like the problems that Node has and things that he would do differently. And so he made Deno, which does those things differently. And if I'm remembering also correctly, the core of it's written on Rust, and it comes with a number of different things. Like there's no NPM with it. It's actually very Go-like, where you can actually specify a remote source for a package and it'll just go and fetch that package. And, but one of the big things I saw was that it comes with a formatter, and the formatter, I believe, assumes a certain number of spaces, and that kicked up the old tabs versus spaces debate on the Twitter.
So it's actually interesting, because that's one of the things I want to talk about with sort of my initial impressions, was that the one of the things that Python does, it uses indentation as code nesting. There's no curly braces, there's no do end. The way you do code blocks is with indentation. I don't actually know the specific rules in terms of tab versus spaces. I think as long as you're consistent with an individual block, I think it's happy, sort of like how YAML works.
Okay.
Although YAML is very, very picky, and my bad experience with the YAML whitespace mismatches make me very wary about dealing with that in Python, but I'm sure they figured it out. Looking at code that a code block that begins with a colon and then has a bunch of indented stuff after it, wow. It's so nice to write. Like, it feels so nice to write because it's just natural. It's how I write. I mean, everything I write in Notion, I basically, all my pages in Notion are basically start an unordered list, type something, hit colon, enter tab. Like, that's how I make my list. It's how I make my documentation. And to write code using that same set of keystrokes and be able to read it sort of top to down, left to right, in that sort of way without any syntactical noise, I didn't expect that to like that as much as I did. I thought it was just kind of hokey and pedantic at first, but wow, it is. It really just does improve readability overall, which is really nice ergonomically speaking. And I don't know if any other languages, you know, like I mentioned, aside from YAML, that rely on whitespace for code, you know, code scopes.
Right. I'm pulling up some Python examples here in GitHub so I can look at it because I need to know.
So just in general, it just seems really nice to read and write. Anything that's really, really sort of, not really dangerous, but sort of reserved, they use this double underscore notation around things. So like initializers for classes, different things like that. Like I think the main function for modules, you know, sort of entry point, is surrounded by double underscores. Again, I thought that was ugly at first. And now I've come over to Elixir, and Elixir uses them all over the place for scary things that you shouldn't touch. And so I've gotten used to it. It's like, oh, it's kind of a reserved word. It's kind of a visual indicator that this is something special and you need to pay attention to what's happening here. And going back to what I was saying before about being a little more straightforward than Ruby, like you see those double underscores, you know this is something special, you need to know about it. It doesn't have like some random name that could be anything. It kind of just stands out a little bit more visually, which again I think is just important from coming from a place where I tend to prefer things to be explicit more often.
And that's a language level convention, not like any sort of community thought up convention.
It's actually both. That's a really good question. Yes, it's a language convention because, like, for example, class initializers, underscore, underscore, init, underscore, underscore, right? But as far as I can tell, you can't really have private, just like JavaScript, you can't have private members on a class. So you just prefix things with a single underscore.
Right.
Which is actually, again, a language convention. There are ways around it, of course. But if you prefix something with an underscore, it won't let you call it externally. So it's kind of both. It seems like this kind of conventions born out of developer conventions. Like for example, when I'm writing, I don't know, C# or Swift, if I have a local variable that's not public, I prefix it with an underscore. It used to be M underscore. I have no idea where that came from, but just to prefix it with an underscore. JavaScript, I do that too, just for my own sanity. And Python just takes that and just runs with it. So that's, again, it's just really great.
That's pretty cool. I always, you know, that was one of the things that people always ask me when we would be talking about Elixir and they would come into it. Like, so Paul, for example, would talk about that a lot. So I would sometimes use underscores on methods or functions, I guess, at this point in Elixir, where I wanted to sort of be private, but I could still test them. There's like a compiler thing you can do to make tests compile or give tests access to your private functions, but I never really feel like that was nice either, because then you have all this sort of config in all of your modules all over the place to be able to test those. Again, you know, like people are like, oh, you shouldn't test private functions, but they're probably right. But anyway, you find yourself in that situation if you're a regular human.
Elixir does actually know about that too, because it will, for example, if you try to tab complete a function on a module in IEX, it won't autocomplete right. The double underscored one. So it does kind of know about that.
Yeah, that's really cool. So yeah, just it's always interesting, like getting into a language like that and trying to figure out what are the code conventions and what are the community conventions and why are those conventions there, and how many people are trying to not agree with those conventions, I guess. But that sounds really neat. I mean, I'm looking at some Python source code now. I just pulled up some random repos in GitHub, and it is pretty readable. There's, like you said, there's not a whole lot of noise. It's sort of, you sort of get down to brass tacks, with it. And I am looking at like underscore init underscore underscore. And at the bottom, I see a lot of if underscore underscore name, underscore underscore name, underscore underscore equals equals underscore underscore main. I don't know what that's all about, but, yeah, it is pretty, I guess, friendly syntax.
I read about that, and I think you can actually do this in Ruby too. I just learned about this recently, but basically you can, so in Python, each module is a single file. So that's actually kind of nice, like one-to-one mapping between files and modules. So you don't have to go searching for where things are defined. And you can, you know, import a module so you can use its, you know, the things that are in it. But you can also just run a Python file directly. And so that's what that if statement's doing, is if you just say Python whatever.py, it'll run that code in that block as if, so basically you could like write tests in there, kind of like the file kind of tests itself. You could do something like there, or maybe you have a library, but you also want a binary executable that you can run command line stuff with, right? You could bundle it all in one file. I think that's what that's doing there.
Yeah, that's cool.
But yeah, explicitly importing code, you know, and modules so that, you know, just similar to Elixir, how you alias and import things, you know, it's really explicit at the top of the file, defines everything you're using, one-to-one map between modules and stuff. And obviously they have a whole packaging thing with pip, and that seems all pretty robust and works how you expect. That's pretty much like, I, you know, very high level first impressions. I'm really looking forward. I'm actually really excited to work on this, because it'll be, if it does things work out okay, this will be another tool in my toolbox, and I'll be able to reach for it if I really need to. At least I'll feel comfortable that I can. One of my particular applications for myself I'm actually interested in is GNU Radio. which is a open source, a huge open source library of digital signal processing for doing crazy RF things, modulating, demodulating, taking signals in from radios, transmitting things, all these crazy, crazy cool things that are actually implemented in C. All the bindings for them are in Python. And they have some nice little drag and drop interfaces where you can kind of piece these things together. But I'd like to expand that and do write other stuff on top of that, you know, put some kind of WebSocket controls and some kind of crazy DSP thing or, you know, who knows, right? Have some kind of automated, write some DSP stuff that, I don't know, that I can't get out of just drag and dropping blocks on a screen. So I'm really looking forward to being able to leverage that because, trust me, I've looked far and wide and there's really no other way to write those GNU radio things unless you're using Python. There's no bindings for other languages, really, so unless you're just writing C.
Isn't that why you start digging into Rust as well?
Yeah, exactly. And Rust does have some of that stuff, but GNU radio is very, very complete.
Right.
It's much more, it's just a huge pool of tools that you can just pick and choose and pull from. You wouldn't have an environment like that in Rust. Rust is more, at least the stuff I've seen, is very small and specialized.
Right. That makes sense. Yeah, I mean, similar reasoning for, you know, running with Jaggi's familiar tech stack in Sidedoor. Lots of prior artwork.
Yeah. The one gotcha I did notice, it raised red alarms in my head. And maybe I misunderstood this. If you create an object, an instance of an object, right?
Okay.
Cat. Cat has a attribute called name. You can initialize it. You say name equals Bucky. Inside that cat thing, you can create additional attributes. So maybe after Bucky's instantiated, maybe it creates some new thing like, I don't know, number of hairballs. But not only can that class create attributes on itself, but also the consumer, like the user of that class, can do that as well, just on the fly with no prior warning. You can just say Bucky.hairballs equals 5. And then suddenly Bucky has a hairballs attribute on it, like okay. Without ever even defining that was anywhere. And that's the kind of typos causing magic that you don't expect. That's just, I'm sure in practice it's not a problem. You know, your editor's going to catch most of that stuff. But that's a level of dynamic structure that I was not expecting. A cool thing is you can define like an empty class that you just say, you know, class Bucky, pass. And if you say the pass keyword, that means basically you have an empty code block. Then you can it's basically like having a, what was it called? OpenStruct on Ruby. You can just have a class you can willy-nilly just add and remove things from.
Sure. Yeah.
Really, it's just like a JavaScript object, actually, if you want to look at it from that angle. So that was a little weird. I was not really expecting that from something that was so object-oriented. That seems very loosey-goosey.
Very open-ended. You can sort of just put whatever, like mutate it whenever, wherever you want to. Yeah, that's interesting. I'm trying to think of a use case. I mean, I haven't done too much OOP, honestly. Just very little Ruby in the past, and then, you know, JavaScript and Elixir aren't really OOP stuff. Obviously, Elixir is functional, so I haven't really got into the weeds of object-oriented programming where I might need a feature like that. I've been digging into PHP more, but I haven't, you know, I just haven't really had to write anything that complicated to really dig in there.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of like really legit use cases for that. I guess if you wanted to sort of attach some kind of metadata to kind of, as you pass an object around that the thing was not designed to handle, you know, you can kind of tag it with metadata or something. And then, you know, I don't know. It's weird. Also, another like, all the code samples in documentation are all references to Monty Python, which, you know, what do you expect?
Yeah, that makes sense. I'm still thinking. I'm just churning on this idea that you can sort of, if you just use pass, you can just do whatever you want to it. That sounds also like maybe an out to allow you to avoid trying to overdesign something up front, right? So I guess like the more situations a class has to handle, like edge cases and things like that, if you're able to, you know, have this more open system, you might not have to try to shoehorn all of that extra functionality. I mean, really, like, you should probably be thinking of solid and things like that. But again, in practice, it's not a perfect world. So I might just like do some reading up on this because this is interesting to me. And I've never, like I said, I've never written any Python, and I've been sort of on this journey recently to pick up more stuff, you know. So now I'm in PHP. Previously I was doing Go. I still write Elixir throughout the week doing some DK stuff, but it's been fun learning some of these new concepts.
Yeah, definitely. Like I said, I'm really looking forward to it. We'll definitely update you as I actually start working on this project when I get some time over the next few weeks, because it is coming up. So it's definitely going to be a higher priority for me now.
Yeah. And you said that you could, you know, it's an extra tool in your tool belt. I mean, can you see yourself using this more in the future? It's probably maybe a little bit premature.
Well, it's funny because as soon as I basically got done skimming the Python docs, I was like, okay, let's go see what's up with Django.
Right.
Heard about this Django thing since I've heard about this Rails thing, which, you know, 10 plus years. How many years has it been? You know what? Don't answer that. Django's been around forever. And I was like, oh, it has some cool things. You know, the built-in admin interface, first party was kind of cool. Just, I didn't know what to expect. So I just started reading through Django and was like, oh, there's some cool ideas in here. This is pretty nice. I would probably never use it instead of Rails, but there it is, you know?
Right. That seems to be what it is. So, you know, Greg, friend of the show, Greg, that Django is his, like, if he has to do a web thing, it's usually Django based. Obviously Insomnia's backend is Go, but there's some reasons for that. There he is. Yeah. Greg's piping up in the chat now, but he talks about Django like very favorably. And he just, if you need to get something done and it's, you know, web-based, Django's his go-to. He's got experience there. For you, that's Rails. For me, I'm trying to make that Laravel, in Phoenix, I suppose. But, that's a similar idea, I guess, is like, you know, using what you're familiar with to get something done and out of the way is, you know, I guess it depends. Like if it's a learning project, obviously you learn something, but if you're just trying to get stuff done, use what you're familiar with and just go from there. So Python has seemed, I've seen people talking about it really favorably on Twitter for a long time now. So I've been interested in it. I just haven't had the bandwidth to jump in on it, but maybe I will at some point. Again, I'm sort of rolling some dice recently on Laravel, so that's what I'm digging into, but maybe after I get to a certain base level of functionality, I'll jump over and check it out.
Anyway, I think that's pretty much all I have to say. That's all I have to say about that.
Nice. Nice words, Gump. Wow, Gump reference. Yeah, so the other thing I mentioned earlier was this episode from Jeffrey Way's podcast, Laracast Snippet. And it's a podcast that comes out pretty infrequently, and in each episode is maybe 10 minutes. I decided to check it out because I've been in the Laravel world recently. And the first episode I listened to was entitled Focus on 2 Hours, Not 2 Years. And I was listening to it, and he basically is talking about how he thinks that every developer out there should have a side project that they work on for a period of time outside of their day-to-day job. Whether it's for learning projects or for focusing on certain skill sets that you want to level up on and get better at, you know, you can kind of choose that. But basically he said an easy way to do that is sort of try to stick to 2 hours. So like, say if you have a side project and you want to learn something, just dedicate 2 hours a week to this thing. Like 2 hours isn't much in a full week. And he said in those 2 hours, you know, don't have Twitter open, don't have Discord open, don't be listening to DNC. Really focus on this thing for 2 hours. And in those 2 hours, week after week, you'll be really surprised at how far you can get a side project or how far you can get into an ecosystem or how much you can learn in just those 2 hours. And I thought that was, it inspired me anyway at the moment, because I've been trying to, you know, kick around these different side projects to learn Laravel and level up on some things. And I always get down on myself because I'll sit down after a day of work and I'll be like, all right, time to get something done. And almost always I'm already tired. You know, I'm already having trouble focusing. There's something else I want to do, and sort of forcing myself to sit down at the computer and force myself to be productive. And so I always leave discouraged, which isn't helpful to nobody, especially not me. So this idea of, you know, I guess like talking, if I'm talking to myself internally, I would be like, yeah, I could probably do 10 hours a week on this thing. That's what I'm going to do. And never hit 10 hours or never like any actual good 10 hours of work. So that's what I've been trying to do, is this just 2 hours a week, which feels like nothing, but it's been really good for me actually, because, you know, I haven't been coding much during the week, so I can kind of get that tech fix in. But also approaching it, if it's just 2 hours, I feel like I'm approaching it with, I actually need to like turn off all social media and stuff because I only have 2 hours. So it sort of gives me more of a sense of urgency on those 2 hours to focus on whatever I'm building.
It's like that. What's the thing called with the timer? The 20-minute timer? I'm blanking.
The timer, like the Pomodoro timer, or?
Yeah, it's kind of like a Pomodoro thing, except a 2-hour chunk, right?
Yeah, exactly. A two-hour chunk where you do nothing else. It could be Saturday morning, could be Saturday night, Sunday morning, whatever. And so actually what I've been doing is I sort of split those 2 hours into 2 1-hour sections throughout the week. So I'll get up, like I said, I just wake up early. So I'll get up and from 8 to 10 or 8 to 9 or whatever, I'll just work on a side project. And that's actually been really helpful for me because, again, I get into the tech world and I get that itch, that feeling of like being productive as a programmer. That's like what I've been conditioned, right? I have to be programming to be productive. So I knock that hour out and then I go into my non-programming work for Sidedoor. I'm like, oh, I feel like I've actually been productive today. And so this other work feels, and it shouldn't feel meaningless, but it feels less meaningless, right? So that's a pattern that I've been trying to do, just 2 hours a week. And really treating those 2 hours as like an important 2 hours of focused work.
I was all ready to get all up in arms when you started talking about everyone has to have a side project and you have to be doing something.
Right.
But then you mentioned time boxing it, and that just totally shifts the dynamic of it, right? I've also been experiencing the same thing, the kind of burnout of working all day and then having to do computer stuff for fun. It's exhausting. Like you said, you're tired and especially with a side project where there's really no, maybe you have an end goal, but really there's no like timeline. There's really no end in sight. It can really seem daunting. Like, oh, what do I work on next?
Yeah.
When you have 2 hours, suddenly it changes from what do I work on to what can I get done in 2 hours?
that nails it. Yeah, exactly. And another point that he made in the podcast is make sure to track what you're working on and track what you want to do and track what you've done and keep that list of things that you've done around for motivation. So again, 2 hours doesn't seem like that much up front, but after a number of weeks, you start to see like the checked off boxes pile up, which I really like. So I've been using Things quite a bit. Just because the keyboard shortcuts are so good. If Notion could have keyboard shortcuts like Things, they'd be the end-all app for me. Yeah, Greg says that we should call them snack projects. But he says, like, you know, if you can see those checked boxes pile up over time, it's really encouraging. And it already has been for me. So part of my 2 hours, again, as a programmer, I tend to just jump into code. And suddenly after 2 hours, I'm like, wait, what did I actually do? I wanted to, like, do this one feature, but I actually didn't get anything done because I ended up pushing, like, divs around on a page, right? And so as a part of the 2 hours, I started focusing on maybe 15 minutes of just sitting in Things and outlining what I want to do next, the brainstorming ideas for this thing. And then maybe 15 minutes of that 2 hours is organizing that, picking out the thing that I'm doing today. And the rest of the time is doing that thing. So it's definitely more focused practicing. And the corollaries for me go back to music. Like one of the best pieces of advice I got back in the day about trying to be a better musician was keep a practice journal, because you're going to get discouraged. You're going to get frustrated. You're going to get really mad at yourself because you're going to feel like you're not making any progress over weeks and weeks. But if you have a journal of like things you can go back and look at, you know, like let's say that you keep a journal 3 times a week and each at the end of each practice session, you do the same exercise, but you record your BPMs or you record the number of mistakes you made or whatever. You can go back in time and see the progress you've made tangibly, right? And so basically, he's just correlating that to the side projects or whatever you're working on learning. You keep a journal, keep a learning journal, keep those to-dos around, and suddenly you have evidence or proof of what you've done. Yeah, reflection journals. Yeah, that's a good way to call it. I'll have to keep that term around, reflection journals.
I also like snack projects. Like maybe at the end of it, you can treat yourself to a snack.
Yeah.
A bag of M&Ms or something.
Yeah, some Oreos. Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah, so one of my guitar teachers a while back, this is pretty wild that he did this, but he was one of the best, most thoughtful guitar players I ever listened to play. His name is Joe Reeser. And what he did when he was younger is he got up every day. He practiced guitar like it was a job, so 6 to 8 hours a day. He got up every morning and put a suit on. And then he went and got his practice journals, and he played for 6 to 8 hours. And
he put a suit on? What, is he in a ska band?
Well, he dressed up like, basically for him, it was like showing respect to what he's trying to learn, showing respect or towards I guess toward, you know, it's like working from home, right? People are like, oh, you work in PJs, right? I'm like, well, no, because then I feel like I'm not really working. I haven't really started to work, if that makes sense. But yeah, he put on a suit and tie every day, and he's an unbelievable guitar player.
I've definitely been kind of in a rut too with my projects. I've just got, you know, I mentioned I finally got one of my iOS apps updated and out the door, and had this big swell of energy to push that through, and it was great, and I got all this great feedback. And you know what? Like, I haven't touched it since then. I think it's been fine. I've been getting some feedback, and I know that some bugs cropped up in the meantime. I just haven't had the energy to focus on it and work on it, because it goes back to what we're talking about before, just having this kind of list that seems to have no end, and it's really discouraging and exhausting. So
yeah,
maybe if I just tell myself to time box it, see what I can get done, even if it's like for example, this thing with Soda Goat. It's a really boring bug too. It's not even like an interesting bug. It's like, oh, the authentication times out after 2 weeks. And it's like, there's like 17 different problems with why that all occurs.
Okay.
And I don't even know how to solve it yet. I know what the problem is. I kind of know how to fix it, but I don't really know the way how to fix it. So right. Like, even if I just spent 2 hours like debugging, trying things, reading docs, and then like making a plan, like that would already be better than just sitting here dreading people sending me emails of why can't I log in? Like,
yeah.
You know? And then I have to be like, just log out and log back in. And like, then they won't bother me again, because they know 2 weeks from now they can just log out and log back in. But that doesn't fix the problem. It just makes my email go away. So it's like stuff like that. When your side project actually, you know, you get past the 80-20 rule and you start to have to work on the boring features of your side project to actually make it a real thing, that's definitely the hardest part of the process, right? It's cool learning technologies. It's fun. It's motivating. It's cool writing, getting concepts on paper, designing things. It's fun. I could spend hours just messing with CSS. Like, that doesn't necessarily get you anywhere, but it's cool. Draw database diagrams, design schemas. That's all well and good, but answering support emails, figuring out authentication, doing deployment, upgrading dependencies, like all the stuff that we get paid to do in our jobs,
right,
becomes a lot less appealing when you're doing it for free.
Yeah.
That's all I'm saying.
The minutia, definitely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is true.
If only we had a framework that didn't require us to do all those things. Magic bullet.
The magic bullet. Well, I mean, just give Dependabot like merge capabilities. Just like let it actually merge the stuff for you.
I mean, listen, that's a start for a side project. Who cares if something if it breaks?
Yeah, I mean, Greg just raised a good point in the chat. He said, but getting to that point puts you in the small percent of people who actually ship something.
Yeah, the trick is staying in that small percentage, though.
Yeah,
it's so easy to lose interest and lose momentum when you've actually shipped and you've gotten that out of your system.
Yeah, that's, yeah.
It's me personally, you know, might be different for you.
Well, I guess it depends on the project. I mean, it is, when you get into the minutia stuff, it is really a chore. It feels like a chore. So I think the free thing probably hinders that quite a bit, right? If doing it for free or no cost, it's basically, yeah, it's costing your time and your energy. So, but going back to the podcast, you know, Layercast snippet, like that really had a positive impact on me on that moment. So I wanted to share that with everybody else. I really liked the kind of the time boxing, like 2 hours. If I'm thinking about working on a side project, I would never think that 2 hours is enough, but it definitely is. So
it's 100 man hours a year.
Yeah. You could do a lot with 100 man hours.
Imagine if you could take a week and a half off from work, what you could get done. You could do that. Just spread out over a year and not get burnt out on it.
Could win a lot of games at Warzone. But yeah. I'm going to do the 2 hour thing. If anyone wants to help keep me accountable, that'd be awesome. And I can maybe help you.
100 hours invested in a game is like nothing these days.
It really isn't. hundreds, thousands of hours in some games is pretty just wild. Think about it. Like, think about what it looks like to Watson. If I'm sitting here looking at a tube, like just light bulbs for 1,000 hours, it's just strange to think about that.
That's what demotivates me to play games, honestly. Like, there's so many games that I enjoy, but to like, my mistake is trying to get involved in the communities and read what people are saying in forums and Reddit and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Those are all like the really hardcore enthusiasts who, I don't know, they could be 14-year-olds on summer vacation and don't have jobs, you know, like they have time to play this. But like, I don't want my games to feel like a job, man.
Yeah,
and
sure,
sometimes
yeah.
when you have to sink hundreds or thousands of hours into a game, like to get to that point, I'm not gonna do that. That's not a game anymore for me, at least with the time my motivation I have to play games. So I've been trying to search out more and more low effort, low stress, non-competitive gaming experience that I can sit down for a couple hours and de-stress.
I think I'm the opposite of that. I can't train jiu-jitsu right now, so I'm not getting beat up. I don't have that feeling of competition. And so games that are highly competitive like that help me get that feeling of, like, it's competition, you know? So yeah, I'm like totally on the opposite end of the spectrum there.
They just released Halo 2 with the Master Chief Collection this past week, and I never actually played Halo 2 because I didn't have an Xbox back in the day. And man, they did. I think I mentioned this with when the first Halo came out on the Master Chief Collection. Holy cow, they did such a good job remastering it. And it's just a fun game. It's just such a great game. It just feels so good to play with a controller. I mean, it feels like just, man, it's just such a great experience so far. And I've been really enjoying that. And just doing co-op multiplayer with my friends through the campaign. And that's like just like the perfect level of gameplay I'm willing to achieve right now.
Yeah. It's really about balancing that. You need that downtime, that recharge time. I used to get down on myself a lot for playing games because I would think like I could be using this time to be productive, but really it's diminishing returns, right? Like once you grind yourself into the ground, you can only be so productive and you need that recharge time. And I've been playing Warzone with a friend of the show, Drew, actually most nights of the week, and I didn't realize how much of a recharge I got from just hanging out on a Discord and talking with friends and, you know, like having Jamie join us and stuff like that. It's really been beneficial for me, like mentally, I think, because it gets me away from the constantly churning, like, what side project can I do? How can I make more money? What can I learn to make myself more appealing to other companies, you know, just sort of just the rat race of being a programmer or being in the tech world. I forgot how much I needed that disconnect. And again, like before the quarantine, I was doing jiu-jitsu and do more hiking and walking. And now, you know, even the dog park is closed. So I get out for walks, but then the whole time I'm like trying to keep Watson paying attention to me instead of chasing a bird or a piece of grass that blew the wrong way, you know? So it's sort of it's been like rediscovering that zone of recharging mentally without being sleeping or sitting in front of Netflix.
Yeah, I hear that.
But should we bring this the recording down, bring it to a close?
Suppose.
Yeah. So yeah, if anyone has any feedback on any of the stuff we talked about, Python, you know, time boxing, reflection journals, any of that stuff, let us know. We'd love to hear from you.
As always, post the show notes over on dnc.show, and you can reach us on Twitter, dncast. Sean is Sean Washbot, which, despite popular misconception, is not the name of a car wash service that magically washes your cars.
Right. It is not.
And I'm Shrockwell.
And as always, everything we talked about today, you know, Python, New Radio, Deno, is it new or GNU? I never know. I hear people say it.
I never know either. I was hoping you would correct me if but here we are, blind leading the blind.
Yeah, well, all that's going to be in the show notes at dnc.show. So if you want to see any of those links, head on over to dnc.show and the show notes will be available to you there. And as always, thanks to Spec for having us and putting us out in the world, and shout out to Drew from Spec. He's hanging with us in the chat right now on Twitch. So shout out to him. And of course, every Thursday, we're starting this new thing where every Thursday in the evening, we're streaming the shows live. So if you want to come in and chat with us while we're recording and toss us topic ideas or ask questions, we'll have a link to our Twitch channel. But if you don't get it from the show notes, it's twitch.tv/DNCCASC. So that's DNCcast on Twitch.
You got it.
I will talk to you next week.
All right, man. Have a good one.